an agricultural empire, the fulfillment of the dreams of pioneers, unexcelled in beauty, rich in achievement, and still offering a challenge mighty as the mountains. This is our Northwest Empire.
I'm Felix Bunnell, resident historian for Cairo Radio, heard with Dave Ross Wednesdays and Fridays on Seattle's Morning News. On this episode of the Resident Historian Podcast, the mouth of the Columbia River has been the site of hundreds of shipwrecks over the years, and now a new digital project is highlighting the deadly history.
And it's hands down the most difficult place I've ever had to operate a motor lifeboat.
And then, from the archives, the 1918 influenza that ravaged the old Navy base on the University of Washington campus. But first, let's go all over the map.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us every Friday morning for All Over the Map, his quick look at the stories behind the names of local places and things. And this week, the Applets and Cotlets factory in Kashmir may be gone soon. The two roads there, named after the candies, are probably here to stay. And that got Felix wondering about other brand-name streets. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, that was the surprising news from Kashmir, that Applets and Cotlets is going away, or the factory's going away. And those streets, particularly Applets Way, which is the highly visible main road over the Wenatchee River and into town from Highway 2, that's a fact of life, regardless of what happens to the factory. Now, I spoke with Greg Taylor. He's a president of Liberty Orchards and makers of Applets and Cotlets. Kind of a complex story. Back in the 1990s, Liberty Orchards actually considered a move west to Leavenworth. It's almost like a sports franchise, but a negotiation began where the city tried to keep Liberty Orchards in Kashmir, and Liberty Orchard asked for a bunch of incentives, like a new parking lot and that sort of thing. Greg Taylor said that visibility in Kashmir for the factory from the highway has always been terrible, so naming the main street into town Applets Way made a lot of sense for his business, and he believes what's good for his business is good for the town. But then word got out, and the whole thing blew up. Even the New York Times did a story about it. Greg Taylor says that New York Times writer Tim Egan described him as a corporate bully, which Greg now chuckles about and people still remind him of every now and then. Huh. Now, the timeline's a little murky, but in the fall of 1997, the Leavenworth deal fell through, and the city of Kashmir balked at most of what Liberty Orchard had asked for, but they did end up renaming part of Division Street Applets Way, and part of Cottage Street became Cotlets Avenue. Now, I talked to the mayor of Kashmir a couple days ago. He told me there's no immediate plans to change those names back if and when Liberty Orchard goes out of business. And also, looking at the map of Kashmir, there's a street there called Apple Annie Avenue, which leads directly to Apple Annie Antique Gallery. So they rename a lot of things there in Kashmir. The whole thing got me wondering about what I think should be called brand name streets, other examples around here. And I have a few quick examples. I know our listeners can think of more and send a text to 98973. Here's a couple. There's Farman Street in Enumclaw. It goes right by the site of the old Farman Brothers King Pickle Factory. Uh-huh. This is a few blocks of the boringly named 284th Avenue Southeast, north of Highway 410. They renamed him in 1981, not for the company exactly, but for the Pickle Company co-founder, Fred Farman. He was the beloved mayor of Enumclaw when he died of a heart attack back then. And the factory closed in 1989, but the street name remained. And, of course, there's Microsoft Way in Redmond.
Of course.
The software giant moved to Redmond from the north-up area of Bellevue. They had been right across the street from the Burgermaster. They moved to Redmond in February 1986. Sometime around then, they took action through a building permit to convert 157th Avenue Northeast to Microsoft Way and to designate their mailing address as 1 Microsoft Way. The earliest online reference I could find with that address was a want ad in a Texas newspaper in September 1989 looking for technical writers. Now, there's a few other ones I could think of. There's Weyerhaeuser Way by the old Weyerhaeuser headquarters and Federal Way. The Boeing Access Road, now by Boeing Field. There's also there's a Costco Drive, both in Tukwila and in Burlington. A couple others that I don't think are quite examples, but they're similar. The Nally Valley Viaduct, which Nally's is gone from that part of Tacoma now. But
is it really
still called
it's
part
just
of
a Pilots. Casual name, I thought.
I've seen it. It appears on Google Maps. I think it's slightly more than casual. Yeah. And here's a couple that I don't think count. Like Rainier Avenue is not named after the beer, right? But the whole town of Carnation, which used to be Tolt, was renamed for the Carnation Company 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So I know there's others out there. There's got to be other names that where companies have been able to change the name of the street to serve as a sort of a brand name street to help promote their business. And I'd love to hear about it through a text line at 98973.
Felix, thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too, Dave. Thanks.
Washington State Apples. The fruit that's good for you.
The entrance to the Columbia River is a notorious spot that claimed many a ship, quite a few lives, particularly in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And our resident historian Felix Bunnell is here with the story of a classic book about those shipwrecks that's been given new life because of a digital mapping project. Felix is brought to us by the King County Library System. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, this book is called Pacific Graveyard by Jim Gibbs. It was first published way back in 1950 by a Portland publisher. There were a few new editions in the 1960s. It was really popular. Pretty much everyone had one in their rec rooms back in the 1960s. There was a poster version, too, showing the mouth of the Columbia River and the locations of hundreds of shipwrecks. Now, the author was editor of the old trade publication Marine Digest. He was a founder of the Puget Sound Maritime Historical Society. And as a young man, he'd even been stationed on the lighthouse at Tillamook Rock. Jim Gibbs retired to the Oregon coast and passed away in 2010 at the age of 88. So now, more than 70 years after it was first published, that old Pacific Graveyard book inspired the Portland newspaper, The Oregonian, to put together and publish an online digital shipwreck map earlier this month. A photographer and a data guy for the paper named Mark Graves worked on the project, along with a reporter named Jamie Hale. Now, I asked Jamie, whose beat is outdoors and travel, why it is that old shipwrecks are still modern clickbait to so many people.
You know, I'm not sure exactly. There's something, I think, about the tragedy of it. You know, I think maybe the same reason people are interested in haunted places, or people are interested in, you know, murder cases. There's something about that we're so sort of morbidly curious about these terrible events. And I think we're so disconnected from that maritime history that, you know, having an opportunity to look back and to remember, you know, all of the things and all of the lives that were lost, you know, in building this world, this community, this area that we love and cherish so much. It's an important thing to remember that people sacrificed themselves in order to make this life and these communities that we live in.
I like that characterization of sort of the morbid curiosity, but also there's a lot of historical context. That appealed to me. And Jamie says, don't just look online and don't wait until summer to visit. You know, winter is a great time to see the Columbia up close from the north or the south side.
When you go out there at the mouth of the Columbia and you see it at that time of year, you know, you can get an idea of, yeah, how hard it was for ships to get through there and why so many wrecked. And you get sort of, I think, a deeper connection with that natural place. You know, you really understand a sense of place and a sense of nature when you're out there and you're seeing it in all of its full force and glory. So I hope people go out to places like Cape Disappointment, places like Fort Stevens, up and down the Oregon and Washington coast, and get a sense of that for themselves.
Yeah, and there's places, you know, public places you can visit to see it up close. And that's one of the reasons I find the story really interesting. I mean, and maybe this is oversimplified, but the physical reality of the Columbia River hasn't changed much in thousands of years. There's some jetties and things that have been built, but the reality there is what it was, you know, for time immemorial. Now, I spoke with Connor Bennett. He's the chief bosun's mate and chief of operations at Coast Guard Station Cape Disappointment. That's on the Washington side of the river. He told me that the dangerous area where the river meets the sea is called the Columbia Bar. And, you know, you hear that in weather forecasts if you ever listen to the weather radio or hear about marine forecasts. And the bar is a geographic feature. It's really a shoal built up from all the sand and silt that comes down the river from all the thousands of acres that it drains. Now, a shoal can change character and location. It's under the water. You can't see it. You throw in the winds and the tide, and that's where vessels can really run into trouble. So Connor Bennett says the Coast Guard has its own broader definition for the Columbia Bar.
For the Coast Guard's intents and purposes, the bar essentially is what we call the area from buoy number 3, which is to the west of here, to buoy 14, which is, you know, well inside the entrance, and it's after you turn a couple of times. You know, that area right there is essentially why this station has been here since, you know, permanently manned since 1878, is because that's where the danger is most readily apparent.
I love that they've been there since 1878. That's like when the federal government was like the big deal to have like Washington Territory. That was one of the benefits of being connected to the United States, was having the Coast Guard, or the predecessor to the Coast Guard. Now, that danger out there is something the Coast Guard has had to deal with anytime they respond to a call.
There's this place called Peacock Spit that's around the north end of the North Jetty at the Columbia River, and it's hands down the most difficult place I've ever had to operate a motor lifeboat. And it's remained that way. I mean, it's been pretty much the same ever since the USS Peacock sunk in, you know, the 1800s, and then it got its name that way.
Yeah, and he described what the water action would be like there in front of Peacock Spit, and it's just sort of, it makes your head spin. And of course, while there have been all kinds of advances in radio, navigation, and safety equipment, what Connor Bennett says, essentially, the sea remains the same.
The conditions here still exist. You know, we've been able to, through technology, through better organization, through better mechanics, been able to mitigate it somewhat, but it's still the same. I mean, the ocean has not changed at all. The entrance has changed a little bit, but there are still ships out there, you know, on the bottom that were put on the bottom 100 years ago.
And talked to a couple different people about this, but it's been a long time since there's been a major incident out at the Columbia Bar. Probably 1913, there was a ship called the Rosecrans where 33 lives were lost and three were saved. And then the SS Iowa in 1936, the entire crew of 34 was lost. And both of those were actually headed out to sea. I mean, that's a part that it gave Seattle a leg up in terms of developing our culture and our economy. The fact you could sail through the Strait of Juan de Fuca fairly easily compared to waiting to get back and forth across the Columbia Bar. So it's these long-ranging effects of these geographic features that sort of, I don't take for granted, but they don't come up in everyday conversation. And so the Oregonian map, it's theoretically behind a paywall, but I was able to access it. I don't know if I have any magical access. Maybe they let you look at something, a few things before you get dinged for a subscription. But if you don't want to subscribe to the Oregonian, you can still find copies of Pacific Graveyard online. It's weird. The publisher down there went out of business. Nobody picked up the catalog. It's kind of in limbo. But I looked. You can find copies of that book for, I don't know, $12 or $13 online. And it's really a classic Northwest text to have in hand, just to know about the Columbia River and what it's meant to our history and economy for hundreds of years.
Well, this is Chris Sullivan territory down there. I mean,
totally.
You've Chris covered there? A few, yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, if you want to experience what those ships were dealing with, they've just finished repairs on the North Jetty. So you can go park at Waikiki Beach there, and they call it Waikiki because of the waves are very high in the winter. That's where the motor lifeboat guys train. You can go out and you can actually walk on top of the jetty. They've made the top so you can walk, so you're not walking on giant boulders. And you can go out there and get hit with spray and realize that just off to your right, as you're looking out to sea, the Admiral Benson, which sank there on Peacock Spit, is still sucked under the mud and sand and still down there. They did a ground-penetrating radar of it, and they still see part of it there. The Iowa is not too far out, and they just did a survey over the top of that, and its boilers are still there, just right across from Peacock Spit there from Benson Beach. So I love this kind of stuff because, I mean, we have a beach house. Our family's had one since 1895 there in Seaview, just up from Milwaukee. And that's, wow. I mean, that part of the history of this region, I mean, I love it, and I'm fascinated by it. And, yeah, it's just amazing to think when you go out there and you see the waves and you just know how they just lost it in the fog or whatever, and they just ran aground, and then they were beaten. The ships were beaten down and destroyed just by the waves. It's incredible down there. Of course, I've got a copy of the Graveyard of the Pacific sitting on my table right by my bed. I don't know why, but, yeah, I also have the map.
Nighttime reading.
I also have the map, too. Yeah. As well. So I'm just, it's something that I've been fascinated with, probably because we spend so much time down there. But yeah, map is great on the Oregonian, too, though they missed one or two, I must add.
If you go out on the jetty, put your copy of Pacific Graveyard in a Ziploc bag, okay?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, so many people go out there and fish there when it's calm. But boy, you go out there, you know, during, you know, the wintertime, it you feel how small you are in relation to the ocean and the power there. It's tremendous.
There are still some untamed places out there, aren't there?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
When you want to know, first, turn to us. Cairo News Radio 71.
For this edition of From the Archives, at the start of the COVID pandemic, we looked back to 1918 and an influenza outbreak among Navy cadets in Seattle.
This takes us to the old Naval Training Station, which was once on the UW campus, and which it turns out was ground zero for the Spanish flu outbreak in 1918.
Yeah, you might remember last year we talked about that hangar along the Montlake Cut there where seaplanes were used, and that was where the boys in the boat trained in the 1930s.
Oh, right.
That was built as part of this Naval Training Station University campus, a big Navy base here during World War I. It came about because of Miller Freeman, whose name was in the news lately because of that mural controversy over
That's
in
right.
Bellevue. Miller Freeman was commander of something called the Washington Naval Militia, which was like a seagoing version of the National Guard back in the first part of the 20th century. He convinced UW President Henry Suzzolo to join with the Navy and create this training station for the demand for the war that was underway. So this is where the UW Hospital and Husky Stadium parking are. I mean, it was just the Montlake Cut had been built a few years earlier. There was actually a 9-hole golf course for students and faculty there, right where the hospital is now, that they'd built in 1912. And then they got rid of the golf course and put in this big Navy base. It was a lot of a few wooden buildings, mostly wooden platforms and tents. It wasn't like, you know, in super luxurious living. But it had been up and running for about a year when the flu hit Seattle. The Times reported on September 20th that the Great Lakes Naval Station outside Chicago was under quarantine. About 1,000 would ultimately die there. By September 28th, there were 200 cases of flu at the UW Naval Training Station among about 4,000 cadets. By September 30th, there were 700 cases. And on October 2nd, a 22-year-old cadet named George Dewey Elaine, who I think was from San Juan Island, was the first to die at the UW, might have been the first Spanish flu death in Seattle, because of these thousands of guys all packed in these tents. And a bunch of cadets had come here from Philadelphia, which is where the worst hit city in the United States in Spanish flu. They'd arrived in the middle of September and went over to Bremerton, but they were in town long enough and there was enough interplay that it just spread like crazy.
No Purell at the time?
No, and people didn't understand. They thought it was a bacteria. They had some serum they were inoculating people with that was completely useless. And they even said that soldiers at Camp Lewis were forbidden from going to Seattle because of the flu here, but they could go to Tacoma because the flu there wasn't as bad. I mean, there was just the science.
They had no idea what they're doing.
No, they didn't. I mean, they had some idea, but not enough to really be very effective. And so ultimately, 1,400 people died here in Seattle. I think 33 cadets died at the station at the UW. But by November 11th, when the armistice is declared, it slackened off enough where they allow the cadets to go, and about 4,000 of them march from campus right here past the radio station on East Lake to downtown as part of a Liberty Bond rally. And the crisis is sort of over kind of simultaneously with the war ending, and the number of cases drop off for a while. There's another spike in December, and there's deaths here until February and March of 1919. But this little naval training station, which was a huge thing, only thing like it in the United States, completely forgotten. I don't think there's any monument. I don't think there's any kind of a plaque or anything.
Well, there is that boathouse.
Yeah, but in terms of like these other 4,000 guys who are on the land there training to be naval cadets, this is sort of forgotten because we still have Fort Lawton, we still have Camp Lewis, now JBLM, but this very important Navy base training place is just sort of a memory at this point.
Are you crusading for another plaque?
No, but it's just this. It's such a weird time right now, living through history. There's this weight that I'm feeling like I felt after 9/11, like I felt when the Great Recession, when the Washington Mutual Bank failed on my 40th birthday. We're in this sense where we don't know how it turns out, and it's a little creepy. I like to go to the past and see how things turned out then for a little bit of comfort, maybe some insight, and maybe just sort of find out things we can do to get through this weird time right now.
Yeah, I would hope that we would be able to handle it better than they did then.
I think the science is there to know what to do, so follow the science is my recommendation as a historian.
Felix Bonnell, all his features are at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm Felix Bonnell at Cairo Radio in Seattle. Follow me on Twitter and read my stories and see my photo galleries at MyNorthwest.com. And please join me again for the next episode of The Resident Historian.
Hi, folks. This is Gene Autry and his Hollywood friends wishing KIRO all the success in the world. So long.